So are you ready? If you're here with us last week, you'll know that Matthew 25, with its three parables, or maybe two parables, and a judgment, are Jesus warning his followers to be ready, for his coming again, when he will end fallen human history, he will complete the last judgment, and all who have ever lived, and he will judge each individual person, and he will redeem his creation, the new heavens and the new earth. And you and I, every single one of us, will be judged. We will be assessed as to the use that we've made of our immense privilege as the saved people of God. And so Jesus is giving us this parable that we might be prompted to think about that end time, every single day, that we are found ready when he comes. So are you ready? Are you ready? Last week we looked at the 10 bridesmaids and how only 5 of them were ready. And we looked at how readiness cannot be borrowed and that one day the door will be shut. And we get a similar warning here. The hub of this parable is invest what you have now to get ready. But perhaps we have a different application this evening. So as we jump straight in, let's look down again at verse 14. Again, it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his property to them. To one, he gave 5 talents of money, to another, 2 talents, and to another, 1 talent, each according to his ability. Then he went on his journey. Of course, in the story, the man is God. God is going on a journey. He is like a Roman viceroy, a man of great wealth who's been called perhaps to Rome to meet Caesar. And in the meantime, he's divvied up his property and he's entrusted it to his servants. The word is actually slave, to steward, to look after his property. The Roman viceroy idea would certainly have been in the minds of Jesus' original hearers. And Luke's version of this parable, which probably was written later, emphasizes the theme of kingship and allegiance even more. We're told that the servants were given talents from the master's incredible wealth. Talent? Got talent? A talent was a considerable sum of money. The original term used was actually a weight rather than an amount of money. Probably we're talking about 30 kilograms of silver, about 6,000 denarii. And if a denarius was the daily wage of a peasant worker, that means, depending on exactly how you calculate, we're talking about today maybe £600,000. So 10 talents, 6 million quid. You know that parables in ancient storytelling were often highly coloured to gain the attention and sometimes to gain the amusement of their audience. And they often contained extravagant amounts and highly coloured scenes, highly coloured language to make their point vividly, to make their point memorably to their hearers. And here the servants are entrusted with considerable fortunes. Sometimes slaves in the world of the first century in the Roman world were entrusted with positions of great responsibility. Sometimes they could be estate managers, doctors. Sometimes they were secretaries. Sometimes they were business persons with the task of guarding and investing the master's wealth. Only here, the amounts we're talking about are striking. They're huge. And they're given this unexpected wealth, not to hoard, but to increase, to invest. Invest in well-thought-out business ventures. And so the original capital is to be increased. Verse 16.
The man who had received the 5 talents went at once, and he put his money to work, and he gained 5 more. Pretty good going. So also the one with 2 talents gained 2 more. Look further at verses 19 to 21. After a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. The man who had received the 5 talents, he brought the other 5. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 5 talents. See, I have gained 5 more. And his master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. Now, this story, of course, is not about a market economy. It's not about shrewd economics, is it? Even, it's hard to say, actually, a specific application for what we as believers have been entrusted with, what our talent is. Don Carson, in his commentary, says this: attempts to identify the talents with spiritual gifts, the law, natural endowments, the gospel, or whatever else, lead to a narrowing of the parable with which Jesus would have been uncomfortable. Perhaps he chose the talent symbolism because of its capacity for varied application. So we do have to be careful not to say today talents are only about this thing, or talents are only about this thing and nothing else. But tentatively, as we apply this, we can say that it's about us as sons and daughters of his kingdom using the grace that God has given us in recognition that one day we will need to account for that grace to God. We will need to invest the grace that he's given us. And that is our first heading, making a grace investment. That's what we're here to do. From that, we could push it further and, holding the application lightly, talk about gifts and opportunities in the believer's life with the command not to waste them, not to waste his grace gifts, but to use them in the service of the kingdom of God. And tied into this all is the encouragement that we shall not lose our reward. Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. So notice that the man who has been working faithfully for his master, he was not afterwards retired into some form of luxury, but actually he was promoted, wasn't he, into greater responsibility. The reward is not more talent, it's not more cash, but it's more responsibility in the new creation. Jesus is really telling us that when he returns and finds us faithful, our reward will not be idleness, but rather it will be more and greater service to God and his people. C.S. Lewis put it like this. He said, the proper rewards are not simply tacked on to the activity for which they are given, but they are that activity itself in consummation. So the new heavens and new earth, creation redeemed, is not a retirement home where we relax and we put our feet up, but it is a place where we shall be given more, not less, to do. More trust, more greater responsibility. But most of all, we shall have more of God's presence and more of God's help in all we undertake in that new world. And all because of investments made in this life. So the man with 5 talents made 5 more. He invested the grace that God gave him. And he will be given more responsibility in the new creation. And so it is too with the second man in our parable. Verse 22. The man with 2 talents also came. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 2 talents. See, I've gained 2 more. His master replied, yet again, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. Notice that the approval and the blessing, it's the same, isn't it? It's the same for both men, the five-talent servant and the two-talent servant. You see, what matters is not the amount of grace and gifting and opportunity you may have, but it is what you do with it. It's what you do with what you've got. And notice too that each was given an amount according to his ability. Verse 15. Now, God does not ask you or I to do what you were never meant to do. God does not ask you to give what you have not got. No one expects you to walk on water. No one expects you to perhaps come up the front and start preaching if that's not what's been given to you. The man who started with two talents and was valued, wasn't he, the same as the man with five. So we should never feel second rate because you haven't got what another person has in terms of grace or abilities or achievements. But can you think of one area of your life, maybe just one area of your life, with what God has given you, grace, kingdom knowledge, gifts, opportunities, with that he is asking you to be faithful. He is asking you to invest in his kingdom during this crucial time that we live between his first coming and his second coming. Is it investing in people in this church? Is it being committed to serving it in a ministry so it's not 20% of people who do 80% of the work as it is in most churches? Maybe it can actually be applied to money itself, coming full circle, investing money for the kingdom. Is it in your witness? Is it in your prayer life? Praying each day, Lord, help me to help someone today in your name, that I can speak of you and that I can multiply, that I can invest your grace. What one area is God helping you to think through how you are to make a grace investment in your life? Just a moment of quiet to consider that, how God is challenging us before we look at the second half of the parable. So God values what you do as a believer. It pleases him. He appreciates it. Its intrinsic worth is great to him, whether it seems to you that it's bearing fruit or whether it seems to you it's successful or unsuccessful. That is why we read in Hebrews, God is not unjust. He will not forget your work and the love you have shown him as you have helped his people and continue to help them. Hebrews 6. And we need that perspective, don't we? Otherwise, our horizons will just become narrow to the dimension of just our problems. Our dimensions will become narrow just to those people causing our problems and just to disappointment where our efforts are not successful, or even we think our efforts are not appreciated enough. And our minds get trapped into our problems, don't they? That can be our perspective unless we adopt the priorities and the perspective of this parable. Here is our true perspective. Christ has come, Christ died, Christ rose again, Christ is coming back, and in that wide horizon are millions and millions of people who are part of the Bible's ongoing story, living between Christ's first coming and second coming. And to each of us, the question is, will we be faithful? Will we be faithful? But for now, look at the sting in the tail of this parable. For there usually is one in Jesus' seemingly harmless stories, but they're never harmless, are they? In this case, it's even been called by one commentator, Craig Bloomberg, as the dominant lesson of the whole parable. And that is our second heading, a warning against unfaithful stewardship. A warning against unfaithful stewardship. In verse 18, we read of the man who had been given one talent. Still quite a lot of money, remember? So he still has great potential. £600,000, what's he going to do with it? But the man who had received the one talent, he went off, he dug a hole in the ground, and he hid his master's money. When his master comes for the reckoning, he tries to defend and excuse himself at his master's expense. Verse 24, then the man who had received the one talent came. Master, he said, I knew that you are a hard man, harvesting where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed. So I was afraid and I went out and I hid your talent in the ground. See, here is what belongs to you. Can you imagine the wry smiles among Jesus's hearers? Because, of course, while no servant would dare say to their master's face what had just been said, it's quite the sort of thing a servant might think, at least. There is some suggestion that the servant might think that he's actually saying a compliment, likening the master to a tribal raider. Oh, you're a man who's successful at plundering your neighbours. You gather where you've not scattered. That's how you make your money. But clearly, this servant has badly, badly misjudged his master. The master's not a thief. He's a rich nobleman. So notice that this servant's unfaithful stewardship distorted his view of his master. This servant's unfaithful stewardship distorted his view of his master. His actions distorted his theology. That's worth reflecting on. That can happen to us too. Our actions, living outside of God's will, can distort our view of God. But then the master's judgment on the unfaithful servant, what was it? It was to leave him with those distorted perceptions of him. Verse 26, his master replied, you wicked, lazy servant! So you knew that, meaning, so you think that, I harvest where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed. Well then, you should have put my money on deposit with the bankers so that when I returned, I would have at least received it back with interest. Now, whilst the Old Testament outlawed Israelites charging interest against one another, interest on money loaned to Gentiles was permitted. But in any case, Jesus is not making a point here about the morality of loaning money at interest. He's saying you should steward faithfully. As it was, doubling one's investing from one talent to two talents might be regarded as a reasonable minimum return in the ancient economy. So yes, we can say that the master is outraged at his loss. Could have been 1.2 million instead of 600,000. But more than that, he's furious at the servant's refusal to take responsibility. By failing the master's trust, he's insulted the master. So it's not the amount, is it? It's the attitude. The man who could bury one talent would bury 10. So the master says, verse 28, take the talent from him, the one that he never used, and give it to the one who has 10 talents. For those who have will be given more, and they will have in abundance. But those who do not have, even what they have, will be taken from them. Now, does that surprise you? Does that strike you as unfair? Well, if we were talking about money, it would be unfair. But we're talking about grace and God's revelation of himself. And so who is Jesus speaking about at this point? Who is this non-investing character in real life? No doubt Jesus' first warning was to his fellow Jews. They'd been given much, hadn't they? But if they do not use that to recognize and to respond to Jesus, they will lose it all. Many of them were too concerned, weren't they, to preserve the traditions and unable to see the grace that was growing all around them. And of course, there are plenty of modern equivalents of that today, aren't there? There are hide it in the ground people in and out of churches, people who think that they have faith, a sort of insurance policy with the judge of all the earth, but they bury that faith in the ground until they die, and afterwards they dig it up and they present it to God as reason why he should allow them into heaven and then into the new creation after. Often it has to be said that this can be true of grown-up children of true believers who retain the form of their parents' faith without seeking the real experience, without seeking the real power of it. Of course, in early centuries, burying treasure in the ground was a recognized way of preserving it. But that's all it is, preserving, not investing. And these people can and do say, well, but I preserve my family Christian tradition, but I've never been an atheist, but I maintained a moral and decent stance in life. I had Christian values. Do you know someone like that? Maybe you are someone like that, who is attracted by the gospel but refuses to be committed to it. You'll never renounce it. You'll say that you believe it, but you do nothing with it. You'll give nothing, you'll risk nothing, and you'll do nothing with your knowledge of Jesus. Now, I know that we're not saved by works, but by grace. But true grace, it does work. It is not passive. It has a power, it has an energy, it has a desire about it. And true grace grows by use. It increases by investment, like a muscle. It gets bigger the more it's used. And it touches other lives, and it enriches them. But buried grace enriches nobody. It's invisible. It's just lying there, hidden in the ground. It's not, in fact, saving grace at all. It's only buried knowledge. And the possessor dies as they've lived, destitute of saving faith. Well, they face God and they're somehow, for some reason, resentful of God. Oh, God, I didn't have the opportunities that you gave my parents or my brother or my sister or my friend. And God will reply, I gave you knowledge. You could have developed it. You never did. You wanted a place in my kingdom as an insurance policy, not as a place of discipleship, not as a place of loving service. You feared me, yes, but you never loved me. Therefore, you will never have me. And friends, the last words of this parable express in an ancient Middle Eastern form, apocalyptic language, the frustration and the anger and the self-pity in which some will therefore spend eternity and throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Jesus does not hesitate to use the most terrifying imagery in order to warn people about such a destiny. The issues are summed up in these words. Those who have will be given more, and they will have an abundance. Those who do not have, even what they have will be taken from them. Those last verses are sometimes repeated cynically in the context of wealth and money, but that is a complete misunderstanding, because remember, it's grace we're talking about, not money. Jesus is talking about grace. And that he is talking about, he's saying that those who use the grace that they've been given will actually be given more grace. Those who develop their knowledge and build on the experiences God gives will know him better and serve him well in the new creation. But the one who does not walk through the open door that's been in front of them their whole life, well, they can't complain when that door is shut once and for all. Listen to those words once again. Those who have will be given more, and they will have an abundance. Those who do not have, even what they have will be taken from them. This was regarded by the gospel writers as one of the most important sayings of Jesus. It's repeated in Matthew and Luke on two occasions, and it's in Mark's gospel too. Always remember that Jesus calls for disciples, not for supporters. He calls for followers, not fans. So if Jesus has begun a work in you, see that it is developed. See that it becomes deep. See that it becomes thorough. Develop it or see it shrivel and die. Use it or lose it. A moment of quiet to reflect on this challenge.